Our last case is 12-429, in re the application of Eric Wilson. Mr. Taurasi?
Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I'm Omar Taurasi on behalf of Appellant Eric Wilson. He's appealing the decision of the Board recommending that he not be accepted, that his character and fitness be denied, and that he not be allowed to reapply until 2016. There are... With respect to his arguments, the first is the characterization of the board. I'll kind of go through the arguments one by one. The characterization of the board that he's been unemployed for the past 10 years is a characterization that he would I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought. I've been a little sick this morning.
Well, counsel, isn't part of the issue is that it's not so much that he's not gainfully employed, although that's part of it. He's not fulfilling his obligations for the loans for his education. And I know there's much made about the fact that he has no consumer debt, but he had four loans for education, and two of them, I think, are maybe in good standing. I'm not sure. And the other two are in default. Is that correct?
That is correct, and that's still correct.
That's still correct.
He is a substitute teacher at the moment. Based on his income that he's able to produce, the best he can do at this time is to keep the two current that are current, and he's trying to do his best to move forward from there. I think the issue here for him is that as we see this case, primarily is about financial responsibility. And they're equating him in as if he has the financial responsibility of somebody who went and got a bunch of debt and sat home and played video games and thereby just let things roll.
There was a little bit of activity there that would suggest that maybe his seeking of employment was not exactly realistic or diligent. He ran for political office several times and used that as a caricature that he was trying to be gainfully employed.
That is true. And I would say one thing to keep in mind is when you are – there's quite a number of people that are in a category of going to, say, Tier 4 law schools that are not in a good position in terms of their academic standing, and they do unorthodox ways of getting their name out. If he wants to start a law practice, which is what his ultimate intent is – if he goes out and gets his name out there on, you know, doing interviews with the media and whatnot, running for office, it's a good way to get his name out, and thereby ultimately, if he wins, great.
So this was an advertising campaign to run for city council and for Congress.
I wouldn't say characterize it as an advertising campaign, but it would be something that he's trying. It's unorthodox ways. Yes, he's trying to get employment to serve the public, and at the same time, it does serve a backup need of getting name out there.
Who knows? He might have been elected, right?
And who knows? He might have. And actually, that's one of the things that you don't know. It's like if look down on him because it was for political office. What if he was an inventor trying to invent something, or what if he was a businessman that tried starting several businesses and they happened to fail? Well, he was trying. He wasn't just sitting at home, and so that should at least give. He shouldn't be put in completely in the category of somebody who was doing nothing and not trying at all. Yes, it's unorthodox. Yes, it's creative. Did it work out for him? Obviously, it hasn't. But he's trying. The factors that I was going to discuss is this issue of his being the recommendation that he not be allowed to reapply for until 2016. I've only been involved in this case for 2 weeks. I did some research, the little bit of research that I went, I started going back to case history from the Supreme Court, how you have handled cases involving primarily dealing with financial responsibility. They come to you, you say, okay, they apply, you say, okay, come back in a year or come back next February or whatnot. What is the, and I found five cases going back to 2004 that fit within that category. And the average that I found was roughly a 1.6-year delay from the time they apply, they come, they get denied, sorry, come back and reapply, and it results in a delay of time. So
but,
far,
but,
he
but
has
that, I guess, would be maybe contingent on efforts made to deal with the problem that was there, you know, initially.
Right. And no case is exactly the same, and I grant that. But still, there's a degree of proportionality. My point is a degree of proportionality where for him, from the point, if you take the 2016 date from the point he initially applied, you end up with 7 years waiting, essentially, since he graduated law school. And that's a very long time, particularly by that point in time. If he's allowed to become a lawyer and start practice, he would be 54 years old. So he'd be 54 years old, 7 years out from his law school. That's a very, very long time in terms of trying to do something at that point.
But my understanding from reading the file is that it wasn't just based on the fact that he was financially, his actions were financially questionable. They asked for some verification because of misrepresentations that were made on applications for the bar and for law school then?
What happened was, yes, roughly 20 years ago in 1992, I believe, he applied and he didn't represent that he had previously been let go for not meeting academic standings at a law school.
He was expelled from a law school.
Yes.
And he didn't disclose that to the law schools that he subsequently applied to 10 years later.
Not 10 years later, like 2 or 3 years later.
All right, 2 or 3 years later.
2 years later, 3 years later. He was caught and he admitted to it basically at the time by one of the law schools. And then since then, he has had 20 years of no problem other than, you know, he did admit that he did do that. He has not hidden that fact that has happened. He did disclose it to the University of Dayton when he applied to the University of Dayton, and it was part of his academic record for 20 years. So that issue, yes, he made a mistake. He made a mistake a long time ago. Yes, it's a valid mistake.
And did he disclose that in his bar application?
I believe he did. He disclosed that on the bar application, as well as on the the one issue that he didn't. I know what they caught him on, or what they in their interview of him, they said. In his bar application, he did disclose that specific incident that he was essentially caught for, or was in 1992. He had apparently submitted to other law schools, and they had rejected him, and that wasn't put on the application for the bar, but it was something that he disclosed when they actually asked him about it in the interview. So,
asked him to do was prove to us that you disclosed the fact that you had flunked out of a law school, mm-hmm. And he never complied with that request.
I believe actually he did comply with that request.
He produced letters that said, you know, from the various law schools that he applied to, that yes, when he applied to law school, he disclosed that he had flunked out of law school.
As far as my understanding of the record is that he disclosed about that the one specific school that he got.
They didn't ask about the one specific school. They asked for the seven other schools.
For the seven other schools, and he was not able. He made efforts to get letters from them, and he was not able to get letters from them saying anything about the topic or supplement the record with any information on those other schools. So that is true.
He had some problems at the interview as well with the lack of cooperation. And apparently the demeanor to the answer in answering the questions, is that correct?
That is correct. I mean, and there's no easy way to you know, set aside the whole record. The record is what it is, and I can't in 15 minutes do, change anything about that. He recognizes that he, I think basically where he's at the moment is he wants a second chance to essentially come back in, reapply, and get it right. He learned from these mistakes. I know many attorneys who have made, you know, embarrassing mistakes their first case or two out of law school or out of once they start practicing. He happened to make a bunch of, you know, very, he didn't understand what the gravity, he wasn't represented by counsel, and he just didn't represent himself very well.
Were any of those unpaid traffic tickets paid?
My understanding is that they are paid at this point, but he, like, you know, he's living paycheck to paycheck to the point so he couldn't even come today because he couldn't repair his car enough to make the hour drive to come here from Dayton. So, you know, it's he's what he is, and he couldn't afford an attorney, but I'm trying to help him out. And his major thing is his what he went to law school to do was to ultimately start a practice. And be able to pay down these debts that he owes everybody. I think that one thing that I don't think he's unique. I think lots of people go into law school with that idea in mind. They saddle themselves up with a ton of debt. And then the question is, are they then irresponsible and can't practice law, which is what they were trying to go through in the first place?
But it's beyond that, isn't it? I mean, when I was reading this file, here's somebody who's graduated from law school who's asking to be admitted to the bar. And not only did he take on new debt when he hadn't paid old student loan debt, he also didn't try to work. Running for statewide or running for city council is not employment when you know you have bills to pay. Then he had a job at some point and left that job to run for Congress, and then was so stressed out after that, took the summer off, and then took a job at 10 hours a week. And then he had one interview with the Character and Fitness Committee. They asked for all this documentation about his inability to get records showing what he disclosed on previous law school applications. Several years later, goes back and says, I didn't understand. I was supposed to bring the written documentation from those other schools. The questions of judgment here are many, and it's not just financial responsibility. This is somebody who is asking to be admitted to the bar, but is making some really incredulous judgment calls.
Yes, there are quite a number of judgment calls there that I wouldn't have made. But I think at this point, he's, you know, hopefully learned from the experience. He is going to be, you know, he's almost 50 years old. At some point, you know, he's you know, has a chance to get his life back on track so that he can.
But is it unreasonable for us to require some documentation of that before we unleash him on the public?
I would, yes. And so then the question is, you know, he of course would ideally like to be allowed to practice, to sit for the bar. I think he understands that that's very unlikely and unreasonable expectation. So then the only question is, how long until he is allowed to reapply and show these that he's got jobs, done his part to fix all of this.
Well, given his past performance, how long do you think it will take for him to demonstrate some stick-to-itiveness to be employed and pay off debt and exercise professional judgment? What are you asking for? When should he be allowed to take the bar?
Well, he would be asking for the February of 2013, which is not that far away, but that's enough time to hopefully get some jobs, get some things going.
So let's say say that's not long enough. What's your second answer?
His answer would be, have mercy on him insofar as, because the farther he go away from the law school, the less he is prepared, the less he is to do, to practice and to utilize this as a lawyer. And so there is sort of that diminishing rate of return. The farther it goes, the more it becomes a sentence of, sorry, you can't practice at all. And he doesn't feel that he's anything that bad to warrant that level.
Well, counsel, I asked you the question about the verification of what he had told previous law schools. And he reported that he had contacted the law schools and had been informed that the applications were no longer available. The Dayton Bar Association then instructed him to obtain letters from the law schools indicating that fact. Notwithstanding that he informed the Bar Association that he had received such letters, he never produced them. And he didn't produce those letters at his November hearing. And his response was, well, you never told me I needed to bring the letters to the November hearing. And we've yet to see the letters. So, you know, this is very recent behavior on your client's behalf or part that indicate that The light has not gone on yet.
It is what it is. And the question ultimately becomes how long until he's given another chance to try again. I don't think that everything that's being held against him is fair to hold against him, though. I mean, there's obviously a lot of problems in the record. I think he realizes that. I grant that. But, for example, and I'll just end on this because my time is up, is the not working while he's studying for exams. I think that if given his shoes, considering he was once let go for not being able to make grades, that's a very economically rational decision to make under his circumstances, even though you can come from an outsider and say, well, why don't you have jobs? Well, his answer would be, if I went and got jobs, I would fail out, so let me study. So he was, from his perspective, he was trying to make economically rational decisions. What about your question about why did he go to law school and take on more debt? His answer was, I was in a debt trap. I couldn't get out of what I was doing. I'm trying to get out of it. Do you want me to sit at home and not try at all? I'm trying. I went to law school. And then you say, well, yeah, but you took on more debt with law school before you took care of the previous stuff. And so it's sort of a chicken and egg situation. From his perspective, he's been trying. And I think that's something that should at least be taken into consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Treherne?
Chief, I think you could tell from the questions that the court has a pretty good handle on his record and what he's done.
Yes.
I would like to get to the ultimate question of how long he's out. I've been on this bench 16 years, and I have never seen a recommendation to go out 4 years. So that troubles me because I've seen a lot worse cases on application than this. What was the rationale for a four-year out, which does have a law of diminishing returns, and why do we treat him differently than more egregious cases than we've had?
I believe it is the cumulative effect of his conduct. And as anybody who reviewed Mr. Wilson in the character and fitness process, as the process went on, he was reviewed by multiple individuals. And as the process continued, additional concerns were raised at every stage. It began with, as with any applicant, the two-member interview team from the local bar admissions committee. And that interview team had two concerns. And their two concerns were the student loan debt and the misrepresentation on his application to the Detroit College of Law. So they refer him to the full committee of the admissions committee of the Dayton Bar Association. The full committee of about 20 members evaluates him at the first meeting in June of 2009.
So you say the accumulated effect that kept going on led to this. Can you give me any example of any other case? Because like I said, I've seen a lot worse cases than this with a lot shorter time frame. Can you give me any case where you've got out this far?
I cannot give you an example of a case that has gone out this far. There are examples of cases where applicants have been disapproved to ever reapply.
True.
That's one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, we have applicants who are permitted to reapply immediately. In the middle, we have applicants who are permitted to reapply after 1 year or 2 years. And I believe this falls in that spectrum between never being permitted to reapply and being permitted to reapply immediately.
So four more years was what you're seeking to help to try to establish some sort of track record. If we put this out to what is our usual for more egregious cases, 2014, is that a problem?
I don't believe that would be a problem if Mr. Wilson could prove his character and fitness at that point.
He would have to go through a whole new character and fitness, right? So he'd have to go through, answer all these questions again, make all this proof, and if he does the same thing, you may come back and say never at that point.
Correct, Your Honor. And if I may address one of the points made by Mr. Tarazzi of this diminishing return issue and him being closer to law school now than he would be in 2016. I think one of the most important concerns that became apparent was Mr. Wilson's appearance at the hearing. And I know the transcript is in the record, but I think it's difficult when you read on paper the transcript, the full effect of his demeanor at that hearing, and it echoed his demeanor at the Bar Association meetings. And at this hearing, we have a law school graduate who shows up to the hearing. He has not submitted a witness list or exhibit list in advance of the hearing as requested by the panel. He shows up at the hearing representing himself, which he had the right to do. As a law school graduate, we would hope that he would be able to adequately represent himself. He appeared at that hearing. He had no witnesses. He had no exhibits. He did not know how to make an opening statement and did not know that he had the opportunity to make one. The panel chair had to advise him throughout the entire hearing of how to practice law, essentially, how to conduct a proper cross-examination.
Well, counsel, wouldn't that be true of almost every law student? They've never been to a hearing before. I was a licensed lawyer and sent to a pretrial. I didn't know what the heck that was when I got there. So I sat there wisely and waited for the other lawyer to do something. I assume these matters are. Now you're talking about a hearing before the panel, right, or the board?
I am talking about the panel hearing before the Board of Commissioners on Character and Fitness.
Right.
This was his fourth step in the process. He has been through three prior steps before he reaches this point in time. In the prior steps, he had been provided a copy of Governing Bar Rule 1. Which sets forth the essential eligibility requirements, sets forth that he had the burden of proving his character and fitness by clear and convincing evidence, and there was no question he received a copy of that. At the hearing, when asked if he had ever reviewed Governing Bar Rule 1, his answer was no. When asked if he was aware that Governing Bar Rule 1 required him to prove his character and fitness by clear and convincing evidence, his answer was no.
Well, it sounds like he might not fare so well taking the bar exam. But how long should we make him wait till he has an opportunity to discover that?
I would leave that up to this court. You know, on that point, I think there's significant concerns if he can't read the very rule that pertains to the proceedings that were of a very serious nature at this point. We're at the fourth stage of the proceedings. How can we be assured that he's going to read the rules that pertain to his clients in proceedings, in briefings before the court? How are we to be assured that he's going to be able to properly advise clients?
I'd like to know how he graduated from law school. I mean, this doesn't bode very well for someone like this to make their way, flunk out one school, and then, you know, tenuously approach another school and then be able to graduate from law school. But I guess that's for another discussion. But you know, I'm wondering, is the recommendation here in the setting out of till 2016 just ducking the issue? Would the bar, Dayton bars as relator, be more honest if their recommendation was he should never be able to take the bar? He's just never going to make it as an attorney.
I think that would be a more honest answer. I think if we go through the essential eligibility requirements, if we go through the considerations in Governing Bar Rule 1, 11D, 3, and 4, I don't believe he's able to meet many of the essential eligibility requirements, and I believe as if we would go step by step through the considerations set forth in Governing Bar Rule 1, Section 11D, 3, and 4, that a flat disapproval would probably be appropriate by the bar. I think we all want to see people succeed. We want to see them be able to use their law degree adequately. You know, this is not an adversarial process. The process is not to, you know, bring down the hammer, but we do also, the primary goal of the character and fitness process is protection of the public. And a secondary and very important goal of the character and fitness process is to protect the integrity and esteem of the practice of law. In this regard, I do not believe that Mr. Wilson has demonstrated that the public will be properly protected by him practicing law. I think there are significant and serious concerns about his ability to do so. And secondarily, I believe the profession's integrity may suffer if he were to be admitted this year, next year, or the year after. My concern about him, you know, pushing him out is he is 50 years old as we stand here today. He graduated from undergrad in 1986. Here we are in 2012, and if you look at his history from 1986 to the present, he has never had significant full-time employment. You know, the board cited that he has not had full-time employment from 2003 through the hearing in 2011, but in fact, if you go back before 2003, we're actually going back to 1986, and it's a very sporadic history. I think that creates concerns that this isn't a matter of going to law school to better yourself and take off a career where you can then pay back these student loans. He never made any efforts to pay any student loans from the 1980s, never made any effort to become significantly employed during that period, and then decides to go to law school, you know, 20 years later. We're not talking about a youthful indiscretion. We're not talking about an individual who has fallen on some unfortunate hard times. We are talking about somebody who has made a conscious choice for the past 30 years to not take responsibility in any aspects of his life, whether it be professional aspects, financial aspects, familial aspects, just a complete and total lack of responsibility in all areas. For that reason, I support the board's recommendation that he not be permitted to reapply until February 2016. At the same time, I believe a permanent disapproval would not be inappropriate.
Is that what you advocated before the board?
I don't believe we made a full recommendation before the board. Before the board, we were just advocating for a disapproval.
All right.
But we accept the board's decision.
Thank you. Mr. Tarazi, you may have 30 seconds.
Mr. Tarazi, was there any evidence or anything to suggest any mental concerns or substance abuse problems with your client?
As far as I know, there is nothing like that.
Thank you.
No criminal anything. There's no substance abuse anything. And I think everything that they're saying is all predicated on a record that they admit is what he was completely unprepared for. And if he's given a second chance, hopefully next time he'll have evidence as to what he's doing, what he did do, and whatnot. And to judge him solely on a record, he was obviously deer in a headlight situation. Is I think too much. I think we should give him a second chance to at least make his case. And if at that point he can't make it, then that's it, you know.
Does he understand that many, many people go to law school and use that education very successfully in a variety of business situations without ever practicing law?
Yes, that is.
Or is he just consumed with the idea that he has to practice law because he now has an undergraduate education, he has a law degree, and it would seem that that would be sufficient training to make him perhaps not in the immediate job market, since it's tough for everybody, including young lawyers who get licensed, but has he explored that other than substitute teaching?
Well, I mean, he lives in Dayton, Cincinnati region, and both of those areas are very depressed, particularly Dayton, economically for any jobs, let alone even law jobs. I think at this point he's trying, and his ambition is to start a law practice. I'm sure if you guys, depending on what happens, he will have to pursue other directions. So that's the situation with that. If I may say one thing, though, in closing, I think that a lot of these other issues aside, there are, going back to your point, of people who are going to law school. The law schools are just taking $130,000 or a lot of money from this. If the court could be a little bit, provide some more sort of, I don't know, about bright line tests or bright line guidance for people, so that people who, you know, don't go into law schools all blurry-eyed that they are going to just come right out and get a be immediately stamped as to what is financial responsibility, what does that really look like, so that people are very well aware before they get into it, that maybe that would help alleviate, so we don't end up dealing with this after the fact. At this point, he's got $130,000 worth of debt, and it's all student loans. It's all on the taxpayer
money.
Well,
are you suggesting, because this is a huge question, that the Supreme Court and other Supreme Courts around the country ought to be sending up all kinds of red flags to young people coming out of college?
I think
go to law school because there are jobs for half of you that will graduate in the legal profession instead of 100% of you, or whatever the number is now. It's very bad.
Yeah. I think
so. Is that on us?
I think that if you put down, for example, a rule that says it's a presumption of irresponsibility to have any student loans in default, that's a very simple, bright-line test. If he had had that before, he probably would have changed his mind about going to law school because he had 30, you know, student loans in default, and then he could plan accordingly. So it's maybe not clear-cut, this is a definite no, but if there's, you know, these are five or six presumptively you won't be allowed in, then maybe people who are, you know, just getting caught up into the system, and ultimately it's going to be on the taxpayers, because at the end of the day, $130,000, who's going to pay that back, you know, and it's money he got from the government, federal loans and whatnot. So if the court could do presumptive red flags to say to people, hey, you know, be really careful coming in. Don't just assume, that you're going to go through law school, and don't come out at the end of the day, at the end of law school with all that debt.
But presumably,
it's something to think
most
about.
Most undergraduates, or many, are going to approach law school with a significant undergraduate debt before
right.
they pile on the law school. That would be true of many people who go to law school and are successful.
Right, but a presumption as to if you have any debts in default. I mean, he had debts in default, and he went into and got 130 even more, assuming that he would come in here and become a lawyer, start making back money and paying things back, which obviously that assumption didn't work out because you're assuming him as being financially irresponsible.
I appreciate what you're saying, but he was in default before he took on the law school debt. I mean, he said in the record that he wasn't paying his student loans once he found out it wasn't reported on his credit report. So it wasn't that the law school caused it. He was in default before, and then he took on this additional debt. And so we're not unmindful of what you're saying, but I think any person who is going to be a professional and responsible understands that they have to pay their debts. That's part of being a grown-up.
Right. I agree with that. I think he was approaching it from the perspective that this was 20 years old, and the misrepresentation on was 20 years old, that this won't affect me. And so he went in with that on perception. If that perception is wrong, then I think that the court can be a little bit clearer that that is an incorrect assumption. People don't make this kind of assumption and then come after the fact and beg for mercy or whatnot. So that, I mean, to the degree that that could be helpful. I mean.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decisions. All right, you're excused.